And now, for your feature presentation.
Just one, or two, or three, or four, but five, Force 5.
What's up, list nerds? I am your host, ex-video store clerk, screenwriter, and fellow listener Jason Kleberg, and this is Force 5, a show where I force my guests to come up with a movie-themed top 5 list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. Back in what must have been 2010, I discovered podcasts. I've talked about it before on this show. The very first podcast I ever listened to was The Film Vault. But at some point, I needed more movie talk, and the next show I started listening to was The Filmcast. Back then, it was called The Slash Filmcast, but it's been going, and in the past 12, 13 years, I've listened to these guys every week, and to this day, I look up to them as podcast hosts. I also know how busy these guys are. Dave Chen, Devendra Hardawar, and Jeff Cannata. They have multiple shows, they have full-time jobs, they have families, but I was lucky enough to book Devendra Hardawar, and talking to him just made me an even bigger fan. One last disclaimer before we get into it, I was pretty under the weather when I recorded this show, so you're probably going to hear that in my voice. I tried to remove all of the coughing and stuff, but if one or two made it into the cut, what are you going to do? We're not perfect. All right, here's Devendra Hardawar from The Filmcast, and top 5 city set car chases. Welcome back to the Force 5 podcast. Today I'm joined by Devendra Hardawar. He's a co-host of The Filmcast, one of my favorite film podcasts, as well as a senior editor at Engadget. Devendra, you've been an inspiration to me in the podcasting world. I'm truly honored to have you on Force 5. How are you today?
Thank you so much, by the way, for listening. It's always wild to hear that. And yeah, it's great to be on. I'm just happy to talk about movie car chases. Like, I love car chases, and I love car chases set in cities. So this is, you ended up being the perfect spot for me to dive into all this stuff.
Oh, it's going to be fun. And we're going to talk about those in a minute. But first, we got to get to know you a little bit. Now, I feel like I've known you for a long time because I've been listening to you for over a decade now.
Oh, wow.
But for those not familiar with you, I find a great place to start is with your cinematic taste. So
sure.
With that primer, what are some of your favorite films of all time?
Favorite films of all time. The one I will point to everyone, and don't judge me too much, but it's Old Boy.
Oh.
I think Park Chan-wook's Old Boy is one of the greatest films ever made. You know, watching that movie, it's one of the things that awakened, like, just the idea of being a cinephile in me. I saw that in college, and at that point, I already liked a lot of movies, but watching that thing certainly made me realize the work behind it. You know, the kind of narrative choices a director can make, the sort of style a director can have. I think that's an incredible film. It's just recently been re-released, and you can now pick it up easily. I saw the 4K restoration that they just put out. And yeah, that's also just one of the wildest films, you know,
yeah.
In terms of twists, in terms of like how the story is told. Yeah, I think that is a perfect movie. Although I would agree with Park Chan-wook, who says like he would want to redo some things that were maybe a little too sexist at the time. And he has shown that he has grown as an artist too. He is one of my favorite directors, and yeah, that is my go-to for favorite film. But I would also include things like The Fountain. I'm a big Aronofsky fan. I love most of his movies. I did not like The Whale too much. But I will go to the bat for Mother or for even Noah. I think there's some really interesting ideas in that movie. But as a director, as somebody who has a firm command of his craft and just really unique visuals, I've always loved Aronofsky. And I think The Fountain is a criminally underseen and underloved movie that shows us, you know, a view of space, a view of love, a view of just storytelling that I think few other films can kind of achieve. In terms of others, I don't know, Akira, you know, like Akira is one of my go-to things too, because I saw that in the theaters. Just a couple of years ago, there was a re-release at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and that is a rare animated movie that is, I believe, animated on every single frame. So even looking at that movie today, it is so goddamn smooth. It is just so fluid how everything moves in Akira, and the amount of detail that's in the backgrounds of like exploding buildings and things like that. Can't help but love that movie. So that is like my main, you know, that's a slice of what I love. But I would say my top five, like changes on a day-to-day basis. I think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is one of the best movies ever made. Did a great conversation around that on the Filmcast recently. I love action movies, which is why I leapt at the chance to talk about, you know, car chases. I also think action movies typically do not get the sort of credit that they typically deserve. There are things we could look back on now, like, man, Predator is an amazing movie, but at the time, critics did not take it seriously. But now you can go back and be like, wow, John McTiernan is actually a brilliant visionary in terms of how he's telling a story. And that goes over into Die Hard and other things too. So I think action filmmaking is to me the purest form of cinema. And that goes back to silent movies. You know, Buster Keaton, what he does is action cinema. And then Jackie Chan ends up doing it, kind of referencing it. So many people are influenced by what you can do with movement on in front of a camera. I will always have a soft spot for action movies, but I'm also, you know, hey, I love everything. I will go to bat for art house movies where not much happens. One of my favorite movies of the last year is, Perfect Days, the Wim Wenders movie about, you know, a man who cleans toilets in Tokyo. That's what the movie is. And you watch him clean toilets in Tokyo. But I think that's also can be as compelling as a car chase, you know?
Yeah, well, you're certainly went to bat for Indian art house movies this year. I listened to your top 10 episode as soon as that dropped, and man, that you had a different list than your co-host there, mostly because you were focusing on those films that you wanted people to see that had smaller audiences.
Absolutely. I mean, that's our top 10 list. Like, to be honest, like, we've done this for so long, for over 10 years at this point, and I like to just that is a chance. I hear we have more listeners than usual with those episodes, and I just take that opportunity to like highlight new things. When it comes to like interesting movies from South Asia, I talked about Joyland, which is a movie that's available now on Criterion Channel. Who's that network, by the way, is doing a tremendous job in terms of highlighting hard to see films. But Joyland is a wonderful movie about modern Pakistan. It's about a man who ends up falling in love with a trans woman, and that just dramatically affects his life. But I think it's beautifully told, and the sort of stories we don't really see too often, in certainly not in South Asian cinema and not in American cinema much either.
Regarding your first pick there, Old Boy, it's crazy to think that movie's over 20 years old now, huh?
Wild. But also wild that Park Chan-wook is just like out there kicking butt. Like, I loved what was this? Decision to Leave mm-hmm. just absolutely floored me. I also love him because he is one of those like directors who used to be a film critic, who was a fan of the form and the art, and like has basically, like Truffaut, right? Like, has just gone on to like master it too, I think, in certain respects. Like, he knows it so well. He knows what he can break narratively and how he can do things differently. I think Decision to Leave showed that quite a bit. He has a TV show coming up soon. Just, I cannot wait. Cannot wait to see that.
Oh, I didn't know about that. That's cool.
Yeah, I think it's going to be on Max, the one to watch for HBO.
Whatever we call it these days.
Yeah.
All right, Devinder, let's talk about the Filmcast. Mm-hmm. So I have been listening. Well, you know what? I don't even remember the year I started listening, but I remember you had Adam Quigley as your third co-host mm-hmm. there. This is before Jeff Cannata. The first email that I ever had read on the air by you guys was in 2013. It was after your Only God Forgives review.
What a movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you liked it a lot more than Dave did.
I liked it. I still think about that movie quite a bit. Yeah.
So do I. Yeah. And I was trying to give a different perspective to Dave. And that was like a really cool moment for me. Like, holy shit, my name was just read on a podcast.
Nice.
But yeah, it's been a long time. So what year did you and the guys start the Filmcast?
That's a good question. I believe it was 2008. You know, Dave and I went to college together. So yeah, a while ago. We are edging close to 20 years. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm not even going to think about that countdown. But no, we had gone to college together. We were roommates at one point. We were always simpatico when it came to film and film nerdery. I remember at one point Dave had gotten Miller's Crossing on VHS, and we like immediately ran to his room just to watch it because I had never seen it before, and he loved it. And that was a transformative like film. It's an incredible movie. So we've always loved films together. In 2008, we were both out of college, wanted to do... Oh, sorry. Let me silence this. Let me take that again. In 2008, we were both, you know, out of college for several years doing, you know, various work and other things. And we wanted to... We saw other podcasts like This Week in Tech, and I think Smodcast was around by that point. This Kevin Smith one. Like, there were a bunch of small podcasts, but it was not like a big thing. And we just decided to be like, hey, we like having conversations with people about movies. We have good conversations with each other. Why don't we just get a couple of headsets and just start recording our chats about things? And I think we only ended up doing like maybe 30-ish, 35 episodes of the first iteration of the show, the Always Watching podcast. But then Peter Serretta from Slash Film, you know, reached out and wanted to bring us over to Slash Film, and we changed our name to the Slash Filmcast. And that's where we were for a while until Slash Film changed ownership. And now we're just The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. But yeah, that is the story. And it's kind of a wild one because I think we were just early. And at that time in 2008, like, we also used Twitter quite a bit too. And Twitter was the great equalizer as a social network, like, where we could reach out directly to big name directors. Like, we could reach out to Kevin Smith to be like, hey, are you interested in joining this thing? And he's a guy who just loves talking. So it did not really take much convincing for Kevin Smith to like come and join us. And I think we talked about the new Watchmen, the Snyder Watchmen together. So we got guests on. We also brought on other film critics too. And these people, like, film critics love to talk, and there wasn't always a great platform for them to do that, especially online. So I think we were among the first. I know Film Spotting was out there for a while too. But you know, it feels really wild to be doing this for so long and to see podcasting still feel like a nascent field. There's something beautiful about podcasting that has been totally corporatized or broken, but also Spotify can come in and spend hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, to buy podcasters and pump up things and totally ruin the ad market. So, you know, it's still rough going, but I feel like podcasting is one of the purest expressions of the internet. And I love the internet. I've loved the internet since I hopped on in the mid-90s. So I think that's why I'm sticking with it and why I like it so much. I could just sit down in front of my computer and have a conversation with somebody like you on anywhere else in the planet. And that's just kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Now, obviously, the show's been going for, you said, since 2008.
So as the Slash Filmcast, I think that was 2009, but still, that's a while.
Long time.
Certainly a while. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and listeners, if you haven't listened to the Filmcast, go check it out. You'll see each episode is titled with the movie that they're going to review, but there's so much more than just that review.
Yeah, you don't even have to listen to the review. You can, like, listen up to when the review starts, which a lot of people do, pause it, then go see the movie, and then come back.
Yep, that's typically what I'll do. I'll listen to what you guys have been watching, and I'll get those recommendations, because that's where you get a couple of those deep cuts and newer streaming things that you got to check out. And then once I've seen the movie, I'll go back and check out that review.
For sure. And we do After Darks as well. So for Patreon subscribers, like, that is where we get loose and get really wild. And for some people, that was the thing we had started doing early on too, because our recordings would just go extra long. So when we would have people on, like Ryan Johnson, like Mr. Ryan Johnson would just come on and hang out with us for a couple hours. This was just around the time when he made Brick, I believe, or right after Brick. So we loved Brick. We fought hard to, like, try to talk to him. But the hangout sessions also ended up becoming a thing, which I think is a very distinct podcasting thing, too. Sometimes you just like to hear your friends hang out together and BS with each other.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget the conversation you guys had with Armand White back in the day.
We've had a few conversations with Armand White, and I think we tried to give that guy the benefit of the doubt because he was a well-known troll among New York film critics, and then he just kind of, I think he had a weird falling out. Like, there was a weird drunken rant he had at one Film Critics Awards, and I think everybody is just, like, giving up on the guy, but he's still out there writing reviews, so, you know, conservative media still loves him.
Still out there dragging down Rotten Tomatoes scores in there. Devendra, in addition to film, I know you're really into emerging technology. You've been working as a tech journalist for years. What does your role at Engadget entail? I know you're part of their podcast as well.
I do. I produce and co-host the podcast Engadget, but I'm a senior editor at Engadget. And actually, the thing I was always trying to do was to write about technology and talk about technology because, again, I was a big fan of This Week in Tech with Leo Laporte. But also as a kid, I do remember watching tech TV quite a bit, you know, it used to be known as ZDTV, and all that stuff was really transformative, like seeing people just having fun with technology, try to break it down for regular users. That's a thing I've always been doing. I used to sell electronics in high school, and when I was selling people things, I would like explain things to them like, oh, this CD burner is better than this one because it has a bigger memory buffer. So it was something I like helping people with tech. In college, I started doing IT work like literally the day I arrived on campus. I just like found the computer center, found the person in charge, like, hey, I would like to work here. So I did that all throughout college. I did that for several years after college. But as I was doing IT work, I was also doing tech writing. And then, yeah, ended up going to freelancing when I moved to New York. I worked at VentureBeat for a bit. And then I've been in Engadget for almost 10 years now. And that feels wild. Again, I've been doing this for too long. Our team has also just gone off some like extreme layoffs. So we're all just kind of like recovering from that. Media is a wild industry right now. It feels crazy to be doing any of this. But yeah, grateful for the opportunities at least. And yeah, go check out Engadget.com. We do a lot of fun stuff there.
Make sure to check out Devendra's review of the Apple Vision Pro.
Yeah. Yeah. I flipped to New York just to shoot that video because my editors wanted like something produced like within our office. And that was a fun experience. And that is a really interesting device. It also like crosses over into the entertainment and film sphere too. Watching movies in that thing is pretty wild.
Yeah, when that becomes more affordable, I'll look into that.
Give it 5 years. I will say, like, watching Dune on that just made me feel like, man, this immensity. I also have like a projector in my basement. I have a home theater set up. I have a 120-inch projector screen, but even that is not as big as the way Dune looked on the Vision Pro. This is just wild.
What's the piece of tech that you're most looking forward to?
I would love to see the foldable phone stuff actually amount to something interesting. Maybe if not a phone, there are rumors that Apple's working on something like an iPad mini that can kind of fold in half. And I think ever since I saw the prototype images of the Microsoft Courier, which was the thing that was rumored like in like 2010, 2012, I've always loved the idea of like a foldable little like computing pad. And the iPad ended up being that thing. Our phones have also gotten bigger, but I'd love to see a cool little foldable gadget. But I'm also really impressed with what Apple has started with the Vision Pro. And there are a lot of people poo-pooing it and looking at the price and saying this can never be viable. This product is not viable for everybody, but I think Apple of all companies kind of knows what they need to do to set the stage for a next generation of computing. And I could see in like 5+ years them releasing something that is pretty compelling and brings over a lot of the features from the Vision Pro. Like, that is an amazing gadget, even though it's still very early and pretty buggy and super expensive.
Yeah, the future is going to be, it's going to be crazy. It's going to be just people walking around in virtual spaces.
Going to be crazy. I mean, the future is probably really going to be holographics. But until you have that, you need to put something in your eyes to like see the holographics. So, you know, who knows, maybe 10 years until holographics.
Devendra, let's talk some movies. Let's talk about car chases.
Let's talk about car chases set in cities, not just any car chases.
Set in cities.
Set in cities. And the subtitle to that is Car Chases Set in Cities, that we should talk about more. Because yeah, I think everyone's going to go straight to French Connection or Bullet. And it's like, okay, I know those are great chases. I love them. But there are also a lot that aren't as praised as those things.
I will say I have, I think, two on my list that are a little less known, and I got one in my honorable mentions that I really want to clue people into that'll be fun. Obviously, you've talked about you're a huge action fan. You could have chosen a number of different action topics. Why did you set on city set car chases?
I think it's a really, first of all, I love a good car chase, but a car chase set in a city is like a very specific kind of beast. Like, there is more chaos and confusion. And you also, like, if it looks real, you also can't help but think to yourself, they're not just like driving fast down a highway. Like, they had to do like city logistics to like shoot between these streets or to shoot in like specific areas. And sometimes I just look at think of the logistics behind that and my mind boggles a bit. Like, oh man, you can drive like that through Paris? That's wild. Yeah. It's wild that anybody was allowed to do that. So I just think like logistically they are more fun, and you know, they tend to, like any good action scene, I think a good city car chase is also a very character revealing moment. All the ones I'm going to be talking about tell you a lot about the main characters and why people are going on these chases. So yeah, I think they're just they're like pure cinema to me is the thing. Like, I love being in foreign cities in a film, but also racing fast through them, doing impossible things is even better.
All right, well, Devendra Hardawar, are you ready to get into our list?
I am ready.
You know what's going to happen? You know what's happening here right now? How do you know what's going to happen?
No.
Words? You just made the list!
Top five city set car chases. Why don't you kick us off here? Actually, before you kick us off, how many do you think we'll cross over on?
I think two or three will probably cross over some. Like, there's some. I am trying to make not quite deep cuts, but cuts that I don't personally hear people talking about more and that we should talk about more.
All right. I'm going to say we'll have one. Because I have one real big one on my list, but the other ones are not like you wouldn't see them typically in a top five car chases of all time. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. All right, Devinder Hardwar, what do you got at number five?
Number five, and I will say my list is not in any particular order except for maybe the very last one is one I want to really like lead into for people. Number five is the Bourne Supremacy finale chase.
He warned them.
I swear to God, if I even feel somebody behind me, there is no measure to how fast and how hard I will bring this fight to your doorstep.
We got a guy coming across the street.
Bourne is a guy with pieces to a jigsaw puzzle.
Take him down.
They should have listened.
I told you people to leave us alone.
He's coming for us.
This is Jason Bourne.
Trace it.
Where is he?
Right next to you.
The Bourne Supremacy. Now on DVD and video.
I don't think people talk about this movie enough. This is Paul Greengrass's, like, you know, stepping into the Bourne universe and also maybe ruining action cinema for the next decade, because he helped introduce the idea of like shaky cam action, which is more more interpretive. Like, you're seeing flashes of action rather than steady shots or very clear choreography. And the thing is, I think he mastered that. I think he, especially Bourne Supremacy and Bourne Ultimatum, show like how you can use that technique to really get you into an action scene, make you feel like you're going through this craziness as an audience member too. I specifically love the Bourne Supremacy's finale chase. This is Jason Bourne in a taxi cab, Carl Urban's Russian hitman. Carl Urban, so good. But yeah, him in like a Mercedes SUV, I believe, them just wreaking havoc through the streets of Moscow. And I remember seeing the scene in the theater. I brought my family to it because my parents would come on the weekends. I went to college about an hour away from my home in Hartford. And they would come and we would just like go check out what the biggest movie is. And we ended up being huge fans of The Bourne Identity. And I remember seeing this chase in the theater and just being like amazed by what Paul Greengrass is doing, because it is so visceral. Like, the camera is in the car with Jason Bourne. You're seeing, it's not like green screen stuff. Like, you're in the car with him. He's turning the steering wheel. Cars are smashing into him. You see the like physical momentum of, you know, Matt Damon being swung to the side when a truck barrels into him. He's driving out into traffic. It is such a visceral car chase, and a great use of shaky cam too, because it does make you feel like if you were in this thing, you would not be in like a steady cam shot of this chase. Your eyes would be all over the place. You would be going insane. And I think that chase just does a great balance of giving you the sense of speed, the sense of like location. You know exactly where the cars are, where Carl Urban is. At one point, they're like across a river from each other, just staring at each other. It's just kind of cool. I think it's just a really well done car chase. And I remember seeing this in the theater, and by the end, you could hear the entire audience just like let out a breath. Like, we had just held our breaths in for maybe 5 minutes through that entire thing, because it's everything. It's John Powell's score. I love John Powell's work in those movies. That particular track is called Bim Bam Smash. I listen to it very frequently because it does remind me of that moment. But it's such a beautifully constructed car chase where it's just pure chaos, it's pure insanity, and then like crescendos to this moment where, you know, Jason Bourne slams Carl Urban's car into a divider, and and music ends, the tension of the scene ends. It is such a masterful scene. And if you have not seen it, it is thankfully now you could just type something into YouTube and like get access to a scene, so you could see it pretty quickly. But you know, I just bought this thing on iTunes because I did not have a digital copy and I wanted to just relive that scene. It is so damn good.
Yeah, that's a great movie, a great pick. I remember seeing that in theaters too. And obviously that was a moment where the audience lets out a collective sigh. But I remember the very beginning of the movie where people let out a collective gasp with the twist in the first 10 minutes when Bourne experiences a loss.
One of the most haunting images too, like just what you see, the framework of that character disappearing into the ocean. Yeah.
And then that emotion is what fuels that chase later on in the movie. And you feel that through Damon.
And that chase is, by the way, fueled by Jason Bourne just wants to apologize to a little girl. Like, that's he remembers that he killed this girl's parents and he wants to say sorry. And Carl Urban is trying to stop him. That's the impetus of that chase. But Jason Bourne really wants to say sorry. It leads to an amazing, like, sort of fourth act scene, too, where it's just him apologizing to a 20-something girl, it seemed like, at that point. But what action movie does that? You know, what action movie ends with your protagonist being like, I am sorry that I ruined your life. Please yeah. forgive me. Amazing movie.
Well, my number five has no apologies, that's for sure. But it does have somebody who's out for revenge. It is from 1973, and the movie is called The Seven Ups.
Roy Scheider heads a determined dirty trick squad.
Who are those guys that shot my partner in the back seat of the car?
In The Seven Ups.
Have Ooh. You seen The Seven Ups before?
I've heard of The Seven Ups. I've not seen it.
All right. I highly recommend this. It stars Roy Scheider as Buddy Minucci. He's a cop who's been... He basically runs this kind of renegade group of policemen. They're called The Seven Ups because...
And they love soda.
They love soda, and they put people away for 7 years or more.
Okay.
And so they're, you know, getting a lot of pressure from people because they use these unorthodox methods. And at one point, his partner is killed, and he goes looking for those responsible, and he uncovers a plot where people are kidnapping mobsters for money.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Now, this was directed by Phil D'Antoni, who produced both Bullet and The French Connection. So he just probably saw those movies, said, you know what, I could make my own. I can make my own awesome car chase. And he nailed it. So the chase starts when Buddy finds his partner left for dead in the trunk of a car, and he sets off after Bo, and it is personal, and you feel that during the chase. It takes place in New York City through the gradients of Uptown New York. You got 1973 Pontiac Granville sedan that's driven by the character Bo, and then Roy Scheider's got a 1973 Pontiac Ventura coupe. And you feel every slide of the tires. It's a really just well done car chase. And Scheider did do some of his own driving, but most of it was driven by the amazing Hollywood stuntman Jerry Summers, who, like, if you were making a car movie in the 70s, you probably called him first. He did the stunts on Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. He did the Gumball Rally, Dukes of Hazzard, Knight Rider, Diamonds Are Forever, and a film that's going to come up on my list next. It goes through all kinds of places in New York. I mean, you're from New York, so this would probably be a really cool watch for you. You see the Upper West Side. You see the GW Bridge. You see the Palisades Interstate Parkway in Jersey, Sawmill River Parkway. And it ends with a car being turned into an impromptu convertible by a big rig, which is, you know, always one of my favorite ways to end a car chase. But if you like movies like Bullet and you like movies like The French Connection, this is basically a first cousin of those movies. And the car chase does not disappoint. When I see stuff like Bullet topping all these lists, in my head, it's like, well, why not give the 7-Ups a shot? Why not give them some shine? So that's why I put that one on my list.
Well, because Steve McQueen's not in it. That's why.
That's true. But you got Roy Scheider, and he's amazing.
I love Roy Scheider. He has such an unconventional face, you know, for an action star. But like Scheider in Sorcerer and everything, it's like, man, movie stars just used to look so different. Yeah, now they all look like supermodels.
Yeah, when you see like a Walter Matthau
in a
movie. Yeah. But this, like, as you watch Scheider, his acting during the scene really makes it for me, because there's other cops that come into this chase, but he's the one that he needs to catch this guy. He needs it. So you see other cops kind of bowing out of the chase or spinning out and stopping, and he just blows through anything in his way to get this guy. And the grimace on his face to say, you will be mine, is really what makes this scene for me.
Very nice. Number four for me would be the Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift.
On the streets of Tokyo, the rules of racing have changed.
It's called drifting.
And if you want to win...
Who's the tourist?
I want to see what the kid's got.
You have to lose control.
Woo! Now what, Paul?
Come on!
The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. Rated PG-13. Starts June 16th.
Ooh,
and I'm highlighting the Tokyo Drift specifically. Yeah, because again, we don't talk about Tokyo Drift enough. But I was a Fast and Furious fan since the very first movie. Again, something I saw with my parents. I remember seeing that was like 1999, or it was that time. But people were just like peeling out of the parking lot after watching that movie. Don't do that at home, kids. Like, not something you should do after you see a movie, but that was the energy of the first Fast and the Furious. I was super disappointed by Too Fast, Too Furious. Not enough car chases, not enough of the D's for me. and Tokyo Drift was sort of a reboot of the series. I believe it was straight to video. as I recall the history, like it was not a theatrical film. Maybe it got a short release, but it was Justin Lin pitching like, hey, I can reboot. I can bring back this. Let's set it in Tokyo about drifting, about the people who would like drift around mountain roads. And then the tease is that the D's would have a cameo at the end, teasing like his involvement in the series again. And I believe there's a whole like background to that too. Like he would do this cameo if they gave him the Riddick rights or something like
yeah,
that.
Like something
there's
like
a
that.
Whole story to that. But I love this movie. It was the thing that made me realize that Justin Lin is an incredible action director, because it is a low budget film. There's not much, like there aren't too many digital effects in the races. Like a lot of it is people just driving cars, drifting them, not even super fast, but drifting them around curvy roads or even around traffic. And specifically, I want to call out the, I believe it's the finale chase, but it's the chase through the streets of Tokyo, where you see the characters drifting through cars, like just through lines of cars. There are surely easier ways to like catch up to the person you're chasing, but the drifting looks so cool. They do the slow drift through the one of the major like crosswalks where there's just like 100 people and they all clear the way for the cars to drift through. A shot which, by the way, shows up again in future Fast and Furious movies, because this is the chase where at the end Han dies.
Yeah.
And I think for years, I also had to live with that too, because they brought the character back and they kind of retconned when the timeline of Tokyo Drift was, and just seeing like how this franchise even dealt with that was hilarious. I love this franchise. There are a ton of great like city car chases within it. The best one is certainly Fast Five and through Rio de Janeiro. But that scene would not exist if we did not have people drifting through the streets of Tokyo. And that's why I want to give this some love. You can watch this on YouTube pretty easily. It's like, as a movie, I think like it's a little shaggy. It has some issues. Lucas Black is not the strongest protagonist. He is no D's and he's no Paul Walker. But it's really fun. It's really fun. And I like the cast that they put together for this. And it's a sort of like misfit group of people, of expats in Tokyo. It's such a different setting for a Fast and Furious movie that I cannot help but love it. So yeah, check out Tokyo Drift if you have not yet.
Tokyo Drift walked so Fast Five could drag a safe through the streets of Rio.
Seriously.
Yeah, when you said Fast and Furious, I thought that's the one you were going to go with. But cool to see Tokyo Drift get some love. I'm a unapologetic fan of the Fast series. All right, my number four is going back to the 70s again. This is one that I really, really hope people check out. If not for the car chase, for everything else, because it is a fantastic movie. I think I watched this for the first time last year, and I know I reviewed it on this show. I love it so much. It's 1972's What's Up, Doc, directed by the late Peter Bogdanovich.
Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal in their biggest hit. See Barbara Streisand, see Ryan O'Neal.
What's up, Doc?
See Ryan O'Neal, see Barbara Streisand.
Get out! No, wait a minute.
See Barbara light Ryan's fire.
I've got to tell you, Miss.
Of course you do.
See Ryan light his own fire. See the CIA, see the spy. See the spy and the CIA, see the sea. See the Volkswagen get busted. See everyone get busted.
This is a fantastic heightened comedy. It's about this accidental mix-up of four identical plaid overnight bags, and that leads to a series of increasingly wild and wacky situations. One of the bags has clothes, one has just rocks, one has secret documents, and one is filled with a bunch of jewelry. And everybody wants a different bag for a different reason. Everybody's great in this movie, but the standout here has to be Barbara Streisand as the character Judy Maxwell. She's this troublemaking con. She has an unmatched wit. I love her in this. I was on a different show, and we did top five characters you'd want to have a beer with. And Judy Maxwell was my number one because she is just such a fun character. But in the middle of this movie, they have a car chase. And in this chase, it starts off with Ryan O'Neal atop a food vendor bike. You know, those they're almost like a reverse tricycle, and it's got the big box on the front. So he's sitting on that box, and Barbara Streisand is riding the bike. And of course, it happens in the greatest city for car chases, San Francisco. Sorry, Italy. I know you got a lot of cool places. Paris, you got a lot of cool places, but for my money...
They got a lot of tight roads over there. Yeah.
Yeah. For my money, though, San Francisco is the place to be. And they start riding this bike downhill, and you go through this 11-minute chase that reportedly took up a quarter of the film's $6 million budget. It is shot across San Francisco. You get scenes in Chinatown, Washington Square. You get a Lombard Street. And finally, you get a pier near Mission Bay where four cars fall into the San Francisco Bay. And during that scene, one stuntman was knocked unconscious. The divers needed to go down there and get him to rescue him. It is an amazing scene with some great comedy as well. You don't see a lot of chases with great comedy these days. This is a really well done chase scene, but it is really funny. It's got those tropes where you got two guys walking across the street with a giant pane of glass, and then they're trying to move through the cars. And then you got the guy on the huge ladder that's putting up a banner, and there's cars going underneath the ladder, next to the ladder. It's just super fun. And if you ever get a chance, so I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, if you ever want to come out and visit, go to the Alta Plaza, where you can still see the damage done to the steps, which this car chase actually changed San Francisco filmmaking forever, because...
I think I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. You have to get certain permits now, and you have to pay a lot of money now.
There's just a big sign, no more bullets. No more bullets in San Francisco, please. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great movie, though. If you haven't seen What's Up, Doc? From 1972, it's a whip-smart comedy with an amazing car chase stuck right in the middle of it.
Very cool. My number three is the opening car chase from Baby Driver.
I'm looking at some of the country's finest thugs. And, of course, young Mozart in a go-kart over there. People love great bank robbery stories. So let's give them something bold, shameless, and brazen as to talk about over their lattes.
You got some Oscar right there.
That's my baby. Baby Driver, rated R.
A movie that, again, I think came and kind of went. And I am a big Edgar Wright fan. He's also, he is one of my favorite working directors. There's like the spirit of Sam Raimi in him when it comes to like his sort of kinetic filmmaking. And this opening scene, I saw this at South By before the movie like officially debuted, and it was like just such a super rapturous crowd to be into this movie. And the opening scene introduces us to Baby, played by Ansel Elgort, and his sort of like unconventional style, right? Like he has headphones on, he's listening to music, and he has set his chase to music. But then it turns out the movie kind of does that too. Like the choreography of what he does is set alongside like a rockin' song. And I've watched this scene over and over again. It's also cool that it is set in the middle of Atlanta. Rather than try to pretend Atlanta is another city, Edgar Wright was just like, let's just be in Atlanta. And I live outside there right now, so I often drive past like a lot of the locations where Baby was waiting for them in front of the bank, or I drive past the alley where he does the sick like e-brake, spin, turn, backflip over, practical effects, like beautiful practical effects, great sound design too. Like this is a movie that's deeply about sound, so you've got the music going, you've got the like great sound design of the car. It's a Subaru WRX, so you really feel the engine and just like all the cool moves he does, like the way he evades the cops, the way he like spins over the highway divide to like match up with two other red cars. It is such a well done scene and such a great introduction to this movie that I cannot help but love it. And I also think Edgar Wright is like a deeply visual filmmaker. I think the fault of this movie is that this movie was written by him too and nobody else. And it leads to a third act that is kind of messy and kind of silly, to be honest. He needs a writing partner, but I still love Edgar Wright so much. I feel like he made this movie after Ant-Man fell apart, you know, and his heart was a little broken. And like to come back and just do this thing out of pure love, that's pure action, you know... It must have felt good. It must have felt like he was exercising some demons from himself or something. But I love this movie. I love this chase. And I would certainly take this over the even the Drive opening chase. I think that's one people go to a lot. But I like Drive. That is more of a tone setting piece. This one is like pure energy. And it's the one I go back to very often.
This is the last movie I saw in theaters three times. I've seen this. multiple times, but I saw it three times in theaters. The first time I saw it in theaters, I was amazed, but my brain didn't even pick up on how a lot of the scenes are actually set to the music, like the beats of the music.
Yeah.
And I remember the second time sitting there watching it, originally I went with a friend and then I went with my wife. I was like, you got to see this. And I was sitting there. It was one of those experiences where you just, like, you're almost tearing up because of what you're seeing on screen, and you've never seen anything like that before. Not only does it have this amazing car chase, it also has one of my favorite foot chases of the last 10 years.
Great foot chase by the end, yeah.
Great pick. This is on my honorable mention, so I'm glad that you brought this up. Mm-hmm. All right, my number three here is from a newer film. This is a Mission Impossible film. Now, out of all the Mission Impossible movies, they all have great chase scenes. I could have chosen the motorcycle chase from 5. I could have chosen the transport of Solomon Lane in Fallout. But I'm going to go with the chase that I think is the most fun. And that's Tom Cruise and Hayley Atwell handcuffed together trying to get away from Pem Clemente's Paris through the streets of Rome.
Our lives are the sum of our choices. This mission of yours is going to cost you dearly.
He knows the best way to get to me. Through all of you.
None of our lives can matter more than this mission.
I don't accept that.
If you haven't seen Dead Reckoning Part 1, or I guess it's probably just called Dead Reckoning now.
Just Dead Reckoning now.
You dropped the Part 1. It's about a sentient AI program, and it has the capability to take over the world, so every country wants to control it. And Ethan Hunt's like, I'm just going to kill it. This is a scene where there are so many different segments to it. That's one of the things I love about it. There's an initial standoff between Ethan Hunt, the CIA, Gabriel's assassins, and the Italian police. And then you have Ethan and Grace driving through the Piazza Venezia against traffic. And if you've never seen Tom Cruise's comedic chops, he's a great physical comedian, and he shows that in this scene.
There's a lot of Buster Keaton in this scene, Jackie Chan stuff too. Yeah,
yeah. It has to do with him being handcuffed, and you've got Hayley Atwell driving the car, and then you've got him trying to switch into the driver's seat, and it's just so fun. And then you have we switch to another car. Again, another great comedic scene. Cruise is like, I got a safe house here. There's a car out front. And he thinks it's going to be this amazing, like, Ferrari-looking sports car. And it's this little electric Mini.
It looks like the car from Lupin the Third, Castle of Cagliostro, the Miyazaki movie. That also features a tiny little yellow car chase, yeah.
Oh, it's so fun. And because it's electric, it's not something like he's used to. And you see the car just kind of spinning around at one point when somebody else is in the driver's seat. It's amazing. Dead Reckoning is not my favorite Mission Impossible movie. I think in my ranks, it's like 4th.
Mm-hmm.
But that car scene is so fun.
They had so much fun making it, clearly.
Yeah, they had so much fun. And of course, look, it's Tom Cruise. So any car chase with Tom Cruise is going to be better just by the fact that you know it's Tom Cruise in that car.
I've had several Tom Cruise car chases like on my list that I bumped down eventually, but man knows how to make an action scene, and he knows how to drive a car. Yeah,
he sure does. There's something to a movie when you know it's the actor in that car, mm-hmm. because the reactions of him slamming into a pile of Vespas, that's him. There's that tumble down the stairs where, you know, the car comes to a rest and they've swapped seats somehow. There's just so many amazing moments in that. So, yeah, out of all the Mission Impossible movies, that one was my favorite. I saw this in true IMAX in San Francisco here when it came out.
Nice.
For like a week before, you know, Oppenheimer and Barbie took it over, but so worth it. I saw those two movies. Well, I saw Oppenheimer in IMAX as well, and I actually had more fun with Mission Impossible. It was just so cool to see on that big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hey listeners, jumping in here real quick to tell you about today's sponsor, Blammo, and their newest toy, Log.
What rolls downstairs, a boner in pairs, rolls over your neighbor's dog. What's great for a snack and fits on your back, it's Log, Log, Log. It's Log, Log, it's big, it's heavy, it's wood. It's Log, Log, it's better than that, it's good. Everyone wants a log.
Log from Blammo.
Watch for Log at your local Tasteful toy stores and make sure to pick up an outfit or two so you can customize your log. Log, it's better than bad, it's good. And now back to the show. All right, two left here. Number two for you.
Number two for me would be The Chase in Morocco from The Adventures of Tintin.
Oh.
Audiences around the world have discovered the phenomenon. On December 21st, it's your turn.
Mr. Tintin, we've been expecting you.
Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson come together for the first time to bring you what critics are calling the perfect cross between Pirates of the Caribbean and Indiana Jones.
We can't turn back. Not now.
Hang on, Tintin!
The Adventures of Tintin in 3D, rated PG.
Again, a movie we do not think about very often, but Steven Spielberg made a Tintin movie. It's pretty good. It's a lot of fun. The only problem is that it uses the weird like mocap CG stuff, and I think people are still weirded out by it. But there is a scene set in a Moroccan city where Tintin, played by J.B. Bell, is going after, I believe, a map or something that Daniel Craig's villain character has, Saccharine. And it's not hard to make a one-shot CG take, but it takes like planning. It takes like imagination to make it look like a believable and fun chase. And I think this movie absolutely does it. Like, it feels like a classic Spielberg chase. You've got the John Williams score going. It feels like a lost Indiana Jones chase, to be honest, with a camera that is just completely free from any constraints. So the camera is following Tintin and Haddock like in this like little, like it's a bike and a buggy down like narrow streets, and then the camera will like fall back, like fly away to follow the eagle that's still the map, and then it's to follow Tintin trying to fly through the sky doing all sorts of different things to catch the eagle. I think it's a really fun chase, and I really wish people gave this movie more of a shot. I wish we got more of them, honestly, because I think it's a ton of fun. It's a good looking chase too, just in terms of like how you visualize action, how you tell a story action-wise. Spielberg was always great at knowing exactly where to put the camera, and you give him a camera that is literally infinite in its possibilities, and he just goes buck wild. And I think it's a glory to behold.
All right, I haven't seen that one, so I got to add that to my watch list.
Oh, yes. It's a fun. It's not like a fully satisfying movie, but, you know, it's co-written by Stephen Moffat. You know, and Edgar Wright, like there was so much going on in this movie that I love. It still looks good, especially if you're not fighting with like 3D glasses or anything.
All right. Number two for me, Devendra, I could not have a list of city set car chases without having a Michael Bay film on my list.
Uh-huh.
Are you a Michael Bay fan?
I am a Michael Bay fan to a point. I think he is a mad genius. And certainly when it comes to action, like he's a good eye that a lot of people do not.
Yeah, I'm a big Michael Bay fan. I think it's cool just to see this person doing exactly what they want.
Yeah, give him a drone with a camera and he goes wild. An ambulance, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of, I could have chosen ambulance for this. I could have. I didn't.
Yeah.
I could have chosen Bad Boys 2. There's a great car chase scene on a bridge there. I could have chosen The Rock, which is another San Francisco one. But what I chose is what I think is, it's objectively, it's not a good movie. It's a bad movie. But it's got two really killer scenes. The film I'm talking about is Six Underground from 2019. Oh,
wow. You know what happens when the world thinks you're dead?
You could take out some truly evil people.
I'm starting to feel it.
Sounds fun, right?
Whatever links to the world these people had, they've cut them.
If they exist, they can be made not to.
We're being chased by some very bad people.
You're such a badass.
Welcome to the world's biggest magnet.
This is all so freaking dangerous.
I'm saying straight up bad movie, but two amazing scenes tucked away in it. And one of those is the fantastic car chase in the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. Now, this plot is absurd. I'm not going to get too far into it. It's about a billionaire played by Ryan Reynolds who fakes his own death so he can form a vigilante team to take down international criminals.
I mean, as you do.
The beginning of the movie, though, it drops you right into the action with a car chase that has Dave Franco. He's just called Six. Each of the six people on the team is just kind of identified by what they do and their number. So like six is the driver, five is the CIA spook, and so on. It's really like video game-ish. But he's driving his team in a bright green Alfa Romeo through the streets of Florence, Italy. And inside the car, in the backseat, you have one of the teammates trying to extract a bullet from somebody. And you have Ryan Reynolds in the passenger seat who's trying to unlock an iPhone with a retinal scanner by holding an eyeball that he's collected from somebody, and you find out how he did that later, over the phone, all while fleeing from the cops and the mafia. So there's a lot going on here. The eyeball at one point falls out of Ryan Reynolds' hands and down into the driver's pit there, and they're trying to fish it out without Dave
Franco
stepping
on it. Feels like a nod to Minority Report a little bit there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of nods in this chase in general. But one of the things I love about this is, you know, this is one of those films where Netflix just gave Michael Bay a duffel bag full of money and said, do whatever you want with it. Mm-hmm. And the carnage in this car chase is insane. In a lot of these car chases, you see cars getting smashed and stuff, but you don't see what happens to the people in those cars. And that's one of the things that I love about this car chase is that when a car evaporates, you see the drivers flying out of the vehicle. There's a scene where one of the passengers on the in the antagonist cars, he falls out of the door, but he's still connected to his seatbelt. And so you see him kind of like dragging on the road until they run into like a forklift thing. And you see his shoes fly off as he just gets stuck on this digger truck. It's crazy. Motorcycles, Vespas, you see these things getting hit and the people just fly into different cars. You got metal poles going into people. And it ends up with what I thought was a pretty surprising death when I watched it the first time. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm probably never going to watch Six Underground in total again. But I frequently go back to this car chase. And then there's a scene with weird magnets on a boat that's absolutely bonkers.
They're good sound system tests, too. It's always good to have a collection of scenes to really stress your home theater, you know?
Yeah. But Six Underground, I don't recommend it as a whole, but like Devendra said, go on YouTube, just watch this chase. Highly, highly entertaining. Mm-hmm. All right, grand finale time. Devendra Hardawar, you got one choice left. We have not matched up at all yet. What do you got at number one?
For number one, I got a movie that I think does pop up on a lot of best of lists, but again, not a movie we talk about very much, and that is John Frankenheimer's Ronin.
It's mine as well.
I never walk into a place I don't know how to walk out of. That's the first thing they teach you.
In a world of covert operatives, he was given an assignment.
This is what we're after.
I want $100,000 up front. I want another $100,000 when you get the case.
But there was more to the mission.
Get out of here.
Walk away.
Than he ever imagined.
The girl sold us out.
Robert De Niro, Ronin, rated R.
And specifically, there's a chase. Yep, there's a chase through the streets of Paris that is one of the most glorious things I've ever witnessed. And it is done, it feels like the end of an era of a type of filmmaking because it's an all practical car chase. It's this movie was made in 1998. It's Robert De Niro chasing character, car driven by Natasha McElhone's character. And just like, it is pure chaos. It is pure just like cars moving swiftly through narrow streets, throughout traffic, against traffic, between traffic, real cars exploding, trucks exploding, vans exploding, just sheer chaos on the streets of Paris. And it looks so cool. And what's funny is that I remember seeing this movie in the 90s being like, this is a pretty chill movie. This is pretty like just X-Spies, just like pretty hanging out. It's like a slow burn thriller. And then this scene happens and just like everything, like the volume cranked up to 11, you hear the score more than you ever have in the film. It is just a beautiful thing. And it's something I think about quite often. And I wish Ronin was up there. Like I wish Ronin was a movie we talked about as much as The French Connection and a lot of these other ones. Like I think this is it's a genuinely great movie made by a master late in his career. Co-written by David Mamet too. So it has like the like staccato Mamet dialogue. It's just such a cool, cool movie. De Niro was in, I guess, a bunch of cool 90s action movies. You got The Shootout and Heat, and then you have this. So just incredible stuff. And this entire scene is on good quality on YouTube as well. So you don't have to see the entire movie to see it, but you should see the entire movie. It's a long movie, but it's worth it.
Yeah, and it's got two really great chases in there.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Is this chase the one that you're talking about where the ambush kicks things off with the grenade launcher?
I think, I forget the actual setting for that because I just watched the clip on YouTube, but it's the one where he is chasing Natasha McElhone and he is aware that she is sort of like, yeah, trying to set them up, basically. Yeah. Just a beautiful thing. It feels like classical filmmaking. It feels like if you were to make the French Connection, you know, in the 90s, that's exactly what this looks like. And it is a pre-CG era. Certainly they had a lot of stunt help, but it just feels so real and visceral. And it sounds so good too. Like the sound of the cars are amazing. I think this is like a beautiful city car chase. This is probably the one that made me fall in love with the idea of city car chases, because like, oh man, look at all that traffic. Look at those. Look at how tight those streets are. This must have been a hard thing to pull off. And this chase, you know, without this chase, we would not have had the Mission Impossible Rome chase, I think. Like that Rome chase exists because it kind of wanted to one up a lot of what Ronan set up too. So I love seeing directors try to like one up each other as well. I think McQuarrie, I've had a couple of his things are in my honorable mentions, but McQuarrie is the new like master of car chases, to be honest, and of action scenes in general at this point.
This is also my number one. When we started, I said, I think we might match up on one. This is the one I was talking about.
Yep.
Such a good movie. Such great car chases. They're not like super flashy cars also, which I think adds to the realism. You have this chunky Mercedes being driven at one point. There's a Citroen, you know, that they're chasing.
Yeah, I think this is a Citroen and an Audi, chasing an Audi. Yeah.
Even to this day, I know back in 98 when I saw it in the theaters, it's like, how do they get these shots? How do they shut down the city like this? Because they're driving at top speed through these narrow streets, destroyed produce stands. They go from the city through the countryside back into the city. And I remember when I first saw this, I hadn't yet seen The French Connection. I hadn't yet seen Bullet. This was, you know, me watching it in the theater in high school. And it was the top. It was the top for me. I hadn't seen anything like it. And it never really stopped being the top. Yeah. And I love how it's bookended by two great shootouts. You have the ambush with the grenade launcher at the beginning. And then you have the shootout at the end where the case is getting switched. In that scene, yeah, it's so good. And you said that you thought there were a lot of stunt people helping him out. There were 300 stunt drivers for the final chase scene alone.
Not surprised.
Devendra Hardwar, amazing list. Let's recap our list real quick for the listeners, and I will go first. At number five, I had the 7-Ups from 1973. At number four, I had What's Up, Doc from 1972. At number three, I had Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning from 2023. At number two, I had Six Underground from 2019. And at number one, Ronin from 1998.
Yeah, my list, my number five is The Bourne Supremacy, the finale chase. My number four was the Tokyo Drift, Tokyo Chase, where Han dies. My number three was the Baby Driver opening bank robbery. My number four was the Tintin chase in a Moroccan town. My number one is Paris in Ronin.
Awesome topic. Awesome list. Now, obviously, it's really tough to narrow these down to five, especially when you're action fans like we are. Are there any films that like narrowly missed your list that you would call honorable mentions that you want to mention?
Oh, for sure. Like there were a bunch of things I wanted to talk about, specifically the first Jack Reacher. It's Christopher McQuarrie, like getting back in the director's chair after being in jail, like in director's jail for a while. And it is a slow car chase. But again, Tom Cruise behind a muscle car, not even going very fast. But it's a really creative chase. It's really it's very visceral and impactful. You feel every gear change he makes. Like he stalls out at one point and like spends like 5-10 seconds like stalling out, trying to get the car started again, trying to pump the engine, like just stuff you don't normally see in a car chase. And it has one of the all time best endings to car chase, too, like where he sees the cops ahead. He's just surrounded. He gets out of he walks out of the car and just stands in a crowd to take the bus. And then everybody sees what he does. They stand in front of him because F the police, right? And somebody hands him a hat to help him hide. And it's just like this, no dialogue. Everybody sees what's happening. It's all very understated. They're like, well, this guy is up to something, but I still don't trust the cops. So here you go, buddy. Just a beautiful scene. Beautiful.
Great music
funny,
in that scene, too.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Great lack of music, rather, because it's just like the roar of the engine.
Roar of the engines, it's cars, it's gear changes. It just feels so good. It sounds so good. That movie rules. The first Jack Reacher has one of the like most chilling openings I can ever think of in an action movie. I remember seeing that at the Alamo Drafthouse, I think, in Brooklyn.
Oh, nice.
And just being like, oh, we did not expect this movie to go so hard so quickly. But you're, you know, through the eyes of a sniper rifle taking down innocent civilians. And I did not expect that. And this, because of this movie, like he and McQuarrie like just became simpatico. Like they're buds now. And McQuarrie went on to help out with Mission Impossible and then take over Mission Impossible. And we're all the better for it.
Speaking of Macquarie, I got another Macquarie on my honorable mentions. The Way of the Gun has an amazing car chase that is very slow, but it's like a car chase that you've never seen before. It's kind of swapping in and out of the car at different corners, and it's certainly one that people should pay attention to.
I love Macquarie. Way of the Gun, it's a fun movie. It's not entirely successful, but a lot of fun, like a nice Saturday watch, you know?
Absolutely. And then one that I wanted to mention that I want to clue more people into, I literally just saw this yesterday, and I saw it last night, and it's like, whoa, I don't have enough time to prepare notes for it. But it's a South Korean film called Special Delivery, came out in 2022. And it feels like a successor to The Transporter. And if you liked Parasite, you got two of the main characters from Parasite in here as your main characters. But the opening of this movie has her driving two guys to a pier, and they get in the car, and of course they're like, oh, it's a woman, how's this gonna go? They have doubts about her, and those doubts soon evaporate as she uses amazing tactics to get where she needs to go, including a moment where she goes up a hill and then puts the car in neutral and just kind of rolls back down the hill slowly to get away from people. It's very Scooby-Doo-ish, like tiptoeing away. It's a great scene. If you haven't seen Special Delivery from 2022, I highly recommend that.
I've heard good things about that. Did you see The Villainous? Speaking of South Korean like action films, The Villainous has a kick-ass city car chase too, on bikes and swords, and also camera that is going all over the place. So we've gotten some good stuff. Great action out of South Korea lately.
Agreed. Devendra, before we get you out of here, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
Sure, you can find me in pretty much all the social networks. I'm at Devendra on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Mastodon. So find me wherever. I'm also on Threads, but I don't really respond to Threads. Just not a big fan of it. And you can also find me at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. And I write about technology and gadget, and catch me on the Engadget podcast there too.
I will put links to all of those things in the show notes. Like I said at the top, you really got to listen to the Filmcast. There's new episodes every week. If you want a good starting point, I love those end of the year episodes, but really you can jump in anywhere. And even if you haven't seen the movie, like we said, just listen to the what you've been watching portion. And stick around for Jeff's limerick. I'll say that too.
I will say a good intro episode may be the Madam Web review, which you don't even need to see the movie. You could just hear us react to that piece of crap.
That is one that I had not seen the movie and just listened anyway, because I have no plans to see it.
For the love of God, do not see that movie. Not even like it is not worth the time of your life to even see it when it's available for free or something, you know?
Before we get out of here, I want to thank all of you listeners for listening to Force 5. And I'd also like to once again thank Devendra Hardwar for making time for me and the show. Please go listen to the Filmcast. It's a great show and one of my podcast cornerstones. If you enjoyed this episode of Force 5, please let me know. You can do that by rating and reviewing the show on whatever app you're listening through. It does a lot for me. It does a lot for the show. You can also email me at force5podcast@gmail.com or on Twitter at force5pod. Intro and outro bumpers come courtesy of Nate Spears. The top 5 list bumper was produced by me with music from Audio Binger. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and go watch some kick-ass car chases.